Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Zora Neale Hurston is firmly in the pantheon of great American writers of the early 20th century, and her novels are still widely read today, both inside and outside the university, especially her classic, Their Eyes Were Watching God. She was a pioneering figure in the literary and artistic movement of the Harlem Renaissance, and perhaps not as well known, but still as important for her work as an anthropologist in collecting and preserving African-American folklore, stories that she saw as a huge American asset and critical in countering the white narrative of Black people in the United States. The manuscript from her first book was never published, well, at least not until now, and it's a book based on her interviews in 1927 with the last surviving person at the time who was kidnapped out of Africa, brought over the Middle Passage through the bottom of a ship, enslaved for a little more than 5 years, freed, and then having have to figure out how to make a new life in the Jim Crow South. His American name was Cujo Lewis. His African name, Oluwole Kosola. Zora Neale Hurston's manuscript of his story has now been published by Amistad, which is from HarperCollins, and it's called Barracoon, the Story of the Last Black Cargo. It is edited by Deborah G. Plant, who now joins me via Skype from Florida to talk about these incredible stories, both of Cujo Lewis and also as of Zora Neale Hurston as an anthropologist. Deborah G. Plant is an African-American literature and African studies scholar with a special interest in Zora Neale Hurston. And she, again, joins me via Skype. Deborah G. Plant, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Oh, thank you. And it's my pleasure to be here. I look forward to our conversation about Barracoon.
As do I. And also to talk about Zora Neale Hurston as an anthropologist, which is a very important story. Again, I think most people know of Zora Neale Hurston for her book, Their Eyes Were Watching God, but also important is her anthropological work. So let's begin there. Tell me about Zora Neale Hurston as an anthropologist.
Hurston, as an anthropologist, as a social scientist in general, is someone who's just vital to everything about what we understand about African Americans, the African American folk, and what have you. And that aspect of study in terms of anthropology at large. So what we know is that Hurston began her anthropological studies at Barnard College, where she came into the knowing, the knowledge of Franz Boas, who is the renowned father of American cultural anthropology. And so she took courses at Columbia, where he was a professor. And she studied with him. She studied with Melville Herskovitz, Ruth Benedict. She knew Mark Mead, all of these kinds of things. And so she was very young, in terms of her years as a college student into that field. And what I mean by that is that she began to study anthropology before she even completed her undergraduate degree at Barnard College in English. And so we see this formalizing of her skill and ability in relation to social science and in specific relation to anthropology and ethnography and folklore collecting. But in reality, it started in Eatonville, where she listened to the stories of people in her town, the sermons that her father would give on a Sunday morning in church and things of that nature. And, she loved telling stories herself, and she loved listening to stories. And she would talk about in Dust Tracks on the Road, her autobiography, she would talk about how she would go to Joe Clark's store, and she would be listening, to the stories and the storytellers, and then she would just, as she put it, drag her feet getting back home. Her mother would have to call for her to come back home because she was so immersed in listening to these stories. And in doing that, of course, she was developing her ear, not just learning the content of stories and the form of stories and how they're told and what have you, but also the listening, which is very important in terms of ethnographic, her ethnographic skills. And so you could say that she was a storyteller as well as, a social scientist who understood those very basic ideas about ethnography, even from her earliest years. So, you know, and this is very important because this is a major part of who she is. We know her, like you said, mostly in relation to Their Eyes Were Watching God. So we know her as a writer, as a novelist. But this part of her, the social science part of her, we are not that familiar with. And we don't yet until now, you know, have the kind of perspective that allows us to understand her on that level. And so what we have with Barracoon is her first book-length work. And this book, which was not published until now, it was, she completed a draft of it in 1931. This constitutes her first work. And she was writing that story while she was also very much immersed in collecting folklore, folk tales in that region. And she was also working on formulating her ideas about Muse and Men, which was her other major anthropological work. And so these works come at the forefront of her career, not later, although they were published later.
This is all happening before she becomes this known writer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We haven't had Jonas Gårdvin yet, which was published in 1934. Certainly not Their Eyes, which came later in 1937, or her later works. All of this is going on before we know her as a writer of novels. The best we know about her as a writer before Jonas Gårdvin is in relation to the short stories that she wrote and won awards for and that kind of thing. So we have a sense of her writing as a writer through those short stories, but the novels began to come in 1934.
Tell me about the importance she put in particular, African-American folklore. I think these are my words, but I think she said something to the effect of African-American folklore was this country's greatest asset.
Yeah, it was her perception and feeling that African-American folklore was the greatest cultural wealth on the continent. What Hurston understood about African-American folklore is that it was where we were going to find not only our understanding of the African-American folk, but that which was original to the African-American folk, that original aspect of us that had its roots in Africa. This is very important in relation to the objectives of the Harlem Renaissance period, where Harlem's Renaissance pundits were looking for exploring ways to basically show and present to white America that which was original to African Americans. And Hurston knew that from her studies as an anthropologist, that the repository of those aspects that were original to African Americans would be amongst the folk. And so she had the skills, one of the very few to have the skills, to go amongst the folk, being of the folk herself, and being able to collect the songs, the tales, the stories, the sermons, all of those forms of oral cultural expression. And what's very important about that is, you know, it's through cultural expression that people tend to evaluate a people. You know, what culturally do you bring to the table, of humankind and human evolution? What's your contribution to that? And it was assumed, because of racism and prejudice and stereotypes and all of that, that African Americans had nothing. And so the Harlem Renaissance period was about saying, yes, we do. And, you know, it was the job of those, what they call young new Negroes at the time, to present these cultural artifacts.
I think of Alain Locke, who we've done a show on not too long ago.
Well, yes, he was very much at the forefront of the Harlem Renaissance period. And You know, he's considered one of the architects of that period, along with W.B. Du Bois and Charles Johnson and James Weldon Johnson and people of that nature. And this is what they would do. This part of their job, so to speak, was to find these quote unquote young new Negroes and support them in every way that they could in terms of their work and their ability to produce, connecting them with publishers, with producers, with people who had money and all of that kind of thing, so that they could produce those forms of cultural expression that could then be basically shown to the world to say, yes, we have a rich heritage too. And not only that, one of the important things about Hurston and her work is that what she wanted to do by way of introducing the public, the reading public, to the African-American folk is what she says in her introduction to Muse of Men. She says she wanted us to see that which the soul lives by. And that's very important because it was assumed by many who were, you know, tainted with notions of white supremacy and what have you, that not only were African Americans not human, we lacked some depth of spirit. And this was, you know, one of the ideas, the notions that Hurston was very committed to debunking, not through any confrontation, so to speak, against those ideas and ideologies, but by showing what we have, not only in books, the books that she wrote, but also in terms of her work as a dramatist.
Zora Neale Hurston in 1927 would travel to Mobile, Alabama, where we have Oluwole Kosola, also known as Cujo Lewis. What name do you go by in conversation?
I use Kosola.
Then we'll go with Kosola. She goes and meets Kosola in Mobile, Alabama. Again, Kosola, he's not an unknown figure at this time.
That's right.
He's been written about before by others.
Yes, yes. She goes mainly because it's part of her assignment when she's in the field on behalf of Carter G. Woodson, who was the editor of the Journal of Negro History and Culture, and also on behalf of Franz Boas, her professor and mentor. And Carter G. Woodson had heard about Kosola, and he had heard about his experience of being captured on the continent of Africa, and he wanted Hurston to capture that story for him. And so while she's in the field, she goes to Mobile, to Africatown, which is that community called Plateau today, but then it was just simply Africatown, which is not very far from Mobile in Alabama. So she goes there to ask Kosola about his experiences being captured and brought to Alabama by way of the Middle Passage. And she interviews him as well as collects information from the Alabama Historical Society, and she compiles that into a report that she submits to him. And so that is the beginning of her communication with Kosola. And after she was in the field at that point in time for just a short period of time. So, but evidently she saw and felt and heard in Kosola's story much, much more that she could get from him in terms of his full story. And so she returns to Africatown toward the latter part of 1927 in December. And she comes again in January, February of 28. And she, over that period of time, begins to have those interviews with him, have those conversations with him, where she draws him out and gets his full story about his life before captivity, the capture, being detained at the Barracoons, at the coast of Ouidah, of Benin, what we know it today as Benin. and the Middle Passage into enslavement in Alabama and his life afterwards. So she managed to capture the full spectrum, the full continuum of his life over that period of time.
Deborah Plant, let's talk about Oluwole Kosola. His story in itself is fascinating. As I said at the beginning, there are really two fascinating stories here that we're talking about that intersect, Kosola and also Zora Neale Hurston. And Zora Neale Hurston writes this manuscript in the form of an interview of Kosola telling her his story. Tell me about, he lives in Africa, Western Africa, I think in around Nigeria, is that correct?
In that region, yes.
Yeah, and he was there until 19. So his formidable years, he really did grow up in Western Africa.
That's right. He grew up in a town called Bante. And he was an Isha Yoruba. And they were an agricultural people and also a peaceful people. And Kosola talks about his growing up time, the customs and the rituals that he experienced growing into his young manhood, learning how to hunt, learning how to track, learning how to defend his community, becoming a soldier, not so much a soldier so that, you know, they can conduct campaigns of war, but because there were those groups that did conduct campaigns of war, they needed to be in some way prepared to protect and defend themselves. And so he was one of the, he had membership in the Oro Society, which was that group of young men who were pledged to take care of their community. And so, and he talks about being a young man who sees a girl and he wants to, maybe marry her. And so he tells his parents, you know, when you see so-and-so, you be kind to her, you be nice to her. And so, you know, this is an indication that he's ready to get married. And he's in the process, actually, of going through the ritual to prepare him for marriage when there's this raid on his village. And so he talks about how, you know, the Amazon warriors, these were women soldiers who were part of the Daumian army who entered into their homes, their village in pre-dawn time and just surprised them in their waking and just committed all kind of violence and slaughter and capturing those that they felt were able-bodied and could be good, quote unquote, specimens as slaves. And so he saw his king be killed and beheaded and so many of his community in his village to be, you know, destroyed. And it was just an awful, traumatic event that he never really could get past that, and you know who could, because in that raid, he lost everyone he knew. Everyone he knew.
When he told Zora Neale Hurston this, and when he was done relaying the story, she just left him as he just stared. I think at smoke from a fire. Couldn't even like he was so wrapped up in his own thoughts.
Exactly.
She didn't say goodbye.
Yes, exactly.
And many years later.
Yeah, and that's how indelibly marked, this experience was on his mind and his heart and his soul. And it's very important, you know, she captures this and she presents it in the narrative in such a way that we feel his pain. We feel we're right there with him looking, you know, into the abyss of the past where such trauma had taken place. And what's very important about this is that this trauma that African peoples experience, if you have any human feeling in you at all, you can't help but be touched by that. And you can't help but understand something about the soul of a human being and how that trauma can just really, it has such a terrible effect on the body, mind, and the spirit.
I want to talk more about this raid that happens to his village when he's 19 in West Africa. And just to be clear, at the time, these were not slave traders. These are not white slave traders. This is a nearby kingdom.
Yes.
And this kingdom, and maybe talk a little bit about this dynamic. My understanding is this kingdom was a very powerful kingdom, a very rich kingdom. And it was that way because what it did was it captured people, Africans, neighbors, and sold them into slavery.
Yes, absolutely. The Fon of Dahomey were just this horrific, very powerful entity in that region. You know, there's so much about the Dahomeyan people and their heritage, their culture, their customs, you know, really remarkable and wonderful. And at the same time, there's this aspect of their culture and society which basically allowed them the belief and the will to capture others within their environment. And this is how they quote unquote grew their wealth as well as their power, and they were a dominant force. What they would do is as you know, the Dahomeyan army would move through the area, the region, and you know, depending on what particular village they were passing, you know, they would ask for food, for provisions for their army. If they were not provided, it was assumed that, okay, you're at war with the kingdom of Dahomey.
That's right. You either provide us food because we are a warring dynasty or a kingdom, since we're not making our own food. So you either provide us with food, and if not, then we're going to take you as slaves. I mean, that was the deal, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That was it. And Kosala's king refused to give up the food that was needed to feed his people. He said, this is for my people. I can't do that. They didn't declare war as such, and they didn't conduct war at that time, but they came back. They went on about their business and circled back and caught them at that pre-dawn time. And like you said, those that they captured, well, they had two uses for the people that they captured. They would use them in their own ceremonies in Dahomey at Abomey, where the capital was, or they would detain them in these barracoons and then sell them to Europeans who would come to get their so-called cargo. So, yes, and in doing that, they waxed rich and became even more powerful. So, yeah, it was the Fon of Dahomey who dominated that region, who captured Kosala, people from his village, and people from around surrounding villages, because the warriors were actually coming down from the north. And when they also waged a campaign against Kosala's village.
And the warriors were women.
The warriors were women and men.
Yeah.
They were women and men. The Amazons were women. And Kosala talks about how fierce they were. And as he describes it in his narrative, it was the Amazons who came into the homes within the village. It was the women who came in to those rooms, to where they were sleeping or just waking up, and committed that awful slaughter. The male warriors were positioned outside around the walls of the village, so that those that the Amazons had not captured or killed and who were trying to escape, if they were able to escape the Amazon women, then the male warriors would then either kill or capture them. So the way it was set up, the women would go in and basically, you know, initiate the first round of slaughter and capture. Any who managed to escape them would be then either slaughtered or captured by the male warriors.
A gruesome story, actually, the way he tells it. He then is sold into slavery, the white trade slavers, and he is going to ship to America on a ship called Clotilda.
Yes.
And we were in conversation with Deborah G. Plant. Again, she is an African-American literature and African studies scholar, special interest in Zora Neale Hurston. She is the editor of a new book, which is the first time that Zora Neale Hurston's first manuscript has been published into a book. It's called Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo, and it is the story of Uluwale Kosola, also known as Cujo Lewis in the United States. Why did he go with Cujo Lewis in the U.S.?
Why did he go with it?
Yeah. Well, was it just, let me come up with a name that people are more familiar with?
The way he explains it in the narrative is that for whites, as he put it, his name was too crooked to call. And so initially, Kosola has only one name, and it's Kosola. And it's only after his, you know, acculturation process into American society and culture that he chooses a second name, which was his father's name. That's where Oluwale comes from. That was the name of his father. He says in the African soil, we have only one name. But here in the American soil, you have to have two. And so where Cujo comes from is that this is a West African name that means boy child born on a Monday. So Cujo is not very far from his cultural roots. And Lewis, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think it's some kind of variation of Oluwale or Lewis, right? So because not very many people in America would take the time to pronounce his name correctly, Kosola, he just went by that, as he says in the narratives, like, well, you know, since, you know, basically you quote unquote own me, then that's what we'll use. And so he used that name, Cujo Lewis, but we're very clear that this is not his choice. This is not his choice in terms of how he identifies himself. And we know that because when Hurston goes to visit with him and, you know, to continue the interviews, she calls him Kosola, and he responds, and she says, you know, when she calls him that, he just lights up, and he responds, he says, I know it's you calling my name, because nobody calling my name from across the water but you. And as they get into the interview, he tells her very, very adamantly, very clearly, very passionately, he says, my name, not Cujo Lewis, my name, Kosola. And so, and that's why I refer to him as Kosola, because this is how he identified. This is who he was for himself. What he allowed others to do in terms of how they called him, that was a matter of convenience, practicality, and, you know, on a certain level of submission to people who were going to basically call you what they wanted to call you anyway. But in his own environment, in his own sense of who he was Kosola.
Hmm. Slavery, as we know, ends in 1865. Tell me about the founding and development of Africatown.
1865, April the 10th, I believe it was, the Union soldiers have come into Alabama, and Kosola is there working, loading or unloading materials from one of the ships, the steamboats that he worked on. And the Union soldiers see him, and they tell him, and says, you're free. You don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to stay here anymore. You don't have to work for these people anymore. You're free. And being free, well, you know, there's being free, and then there is, okay, now within this new status that I have, what do I do? And the soldiers told him, like, you know, there are some houses there that you can go where you can have some kind of some place to stay and that kind of thing. But basically, they had to figure it out for themselves what to do. They didn't have, Kosla and his compatriots, they didn't have, you know, anyone to come and tell them about the Freedmen's Bureau and all of that kind of thing. Some others in the environment did, but he did not. And in their starting over, they had a little shelter, but in the starting over, what they did was basically begin to work at those places where they were held in bondage. In doing that work and getting paid some little wage for that, they thought that they could go home. They could save enough money to return to their home, which is what they wanted to do, always wanted to do. And when they found that they could never save enough because the passage, the cost was so dear, that they resolved that they had to stay in where they were, in Alabama. And having resolved to stay where they were, they said, well, we're going to need some land to build our houses on. They couldn't just, you know, continue to stay in the shelters that they were in. They wanted their own homes. And so their reasoning was that, you know, Timothy Mayer brought them over into, they stole them and brought them over into Alabama, took them away from a land where they, a place, a home where they had land, they had means to make a living for themselves, and they were taken away from that and brought into Alabama. So their reasoning was that Timothy Mayer ought to assist them in getting back to Africa, for one thing, and that's when they decided they would try to save and return. They decided they would do that themselves rather than ask Mayer for passage home. But when they found that they couldn't go, they said that they would ask Timothy Mayer for some land so that they could build their homes. So Kosla was chosen by the group to go and speak with Timothy Mayer. And he's in the woods one day chopping. Timothy Mayer had a paper mill and all that kind of thing. And so he was working, chopping wood when Timothy Mayer came. And Kosla said, you know, he felt like this was the right time to speak for his people, to speak for land for his people. So he stops chopping, you know, this tree that he's chopping down, and Timothy Mayer is there, and as Kosla puts it, no longer does he hear the axe fall on the tree, and so he looks up, and he asks Kosla, "Why are you so sad?" And Kosla says, you know, he wants land so bad for his people that he just wants to cry. And so he tells him, he says, "Captain Tim, you brought us here to America. We had land in Africa, and over here we have nothing. They free us, but they free us with nothing. And, you know, since you brought us here, why don't you give us a little piece of this land?" And Timothy Mayer jumps up and he calls him a fool. He says, "Fool, do you think I'm going to throw property after property? I'm not going to give you anything. I took good care of my slaves during slavery time, and you don't belong to me no how, no more anyway. I don't owe you anything." And so this is what Kosla had to take back to his community. And so what the community decided was, you know what, then we'll just buy that piece of land. And so they worked, the men worked, the women worked, and they pooled their monies, and they bought one parcel of land and then another. And amongst them, from 1 acre to 2 to 3 to however many that, you know, they were able to buy, then on that land, they founded Africatown. Once they had the land, as Khosla explains it in his narrative, then they didn't get hire people to build their houses for them. They built their houses themselves, and they would all help one another to, you know, communally build the houses that for people who were ready to build their houses. And so this is how, this is the foundation of Africatown.
How long would it last? Some town there still exists today, but it's not called Africatown anymore.
It is called Africatown. It's still called Africatown.
Oh,
but what's called Africatown is the community in what is now called Plateau, Alabama. So within Plateau, Alabama is the community of Africatown. And that community is still there. When I began my research to edit the manuscript, one of the first things I did was to take that trip to Africatown. And so it's very much still there. One of the things I wanted to see was his grave site, to visit it, to pay homage, to pay my respects, and to invite his blessings with the work that I had begun to do. And I also, when I was there, there's a church there which is on the same spot of the original church that they had built. Because, you know, once they began to formulate Africatown, they not only built their homes, they built a church, they built schools, they built everything that a town needs. They just were never incorporated. And so visiting the old landmark church, what was originally the old landmark Baptist church, on my own visit to Africatown last year, I met several members of the Africatown community at that church. And amongst those that I met was a great-granddaughter of Khosla.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, they allowed us, I was there with my sister, Gloria Jean Plant Gilbert, and they allowed us to go into the church and to, see, there is a really nice big portrait of Khosla within the church, and talk about the church and Khosla's role in it and all that kind of thing. He was sexton of the church once he was hurt in an accident where he was hit by a train and wasn't able to work at the mill any longer, and so he began to work as a sexton for the church. And so we got to experience not only the town, but the love and warmth of a lot of the people of the town.
Interesting. Deborah Plant, we're almost out of time, but tell me why here we are some 90 years after Zora Neale Hurston meets with Oluwole Khosla. Why just now is this book being published?
Well, that's the question, right? And I can give you some practical answers to that. And they can make sense, like publishers at the time did not want to publish a manuscript that was written in the style that Hurston had written Khosla's story. And, there are evidence of, publishers saying, this is too anthropological, it's too... The dialect, can you change that?
The dialect was written as Khosla would have spoken. At least that's what we think.
Absolutely. One of the primary objectives of an ethnographer is to capture as well as possible, as completely as possible, the language of an informant. And that means, writing in dialect. How does the person say something? How does the person pronounce words? What kind of syntax? And, whatever the sounds are, whatever the rhythms are, the semantics, or what Hurston calls the idioms of that language, you want to capture that as completely, as authentically as possible, because the language is one of the authenticating features of an ethnographic portrait. And so you want to capture that. One of the things that is very important that we miss about the fact that he's speaking in the way we hear him, quote unquote, hear him speak, and we do hear him speak in his narrative. It's an oral narrative, and so we get a sense of how he would say something. The thing that we often miss is that this dialect, this vernacular, is not his first language, right? His first language is some form of Yoruba.
Yeah.
Right? He didn't speak Black English or the Black vernacular when he was in Bante, West Africa. He had to learn to speak this language that he used to facilitate his communication in America. So the thing about that is that when we look at the language that he has come to speak, this vernacular that he has put together to communicate with people, the question is why and how? And in that dialect is the history of Kosala. In that dialect is the history of what happened to him as he has had to figure out how to combine the words of strangers he had never seen in his life, how to combine those words with the grammar that is present in his cognitive structure. You know, this is what a dialect is about. This is what an Atlantic Creole is about. It's about this coming together, and in this case, in very forceful, brutal ways, this linguistic expression under duress, in a context of violence and subjugation and domination. And so encoded in his language is all that history.
Finally, Zora Neale Hurston did write an article about him and in her meetings with him that was published. And,
yes.
And she was accused of plagiarism.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, number one, Hurston was not a plagiarist. She was not, never was, and never will be. And I say that because, you know, what a lot is presumed about that article. And what is presumed about it is that Hurston wrote it, and as an article that she had published. What really that article was, it was a report, just like the other report that was published in that same journal in 1927. And in that article was titled Communications. And when Hurston was in the field on behalf of Carter G. Woodson, he had her going to different archives to gather information about the things he was interested in. In Florida, he had her gather information about Fort Mose and all of the history around that. And so you'll see in that article titled Communications, the compilation of information that she had compiled from those archives. She did the same thing in Alabama, in Mobile, in terms of compiling information from archives and with the addition that she actually also had an interview with Kosala. And she compiled that into a report that she submitted to Carter G. Woodson. She did not necessarily know, and I don't believe she did, that this would be published, but it was published. Now, knowing Hurston, if you spending time reading her and about her writing and whatnot, whenever she's about to have something published or she got something published, she would let the world know about it. But these were reports. And and submitted to Carter G. Woodson. And the thing about plagiarism as well is that when, you know, when we look at that definition, one of the key aspects of any definition of plagiarism is the intent to take someone's work as your own. And we can ask ourselves, did she intend to take someone's work as her own? And I would say no. I would say no. Why would she need to? Zora Neale Hurston was down there capturing all kinds of stories. She had stories just, you know, as she said to in one letter to Langston Hughes, that she was like sweeping like a new broom. She was collecting so many stories. She had no need of taking anybody's work or their words. She was a trained folklorist and ethnographer who knew how to get her own story, which is what she came back to do. So the issue of plagiarism, I think, is one that says that scholars who have looked at the work and looked at Hurston in that way, I think they don't have all of the information. I think a lot of assumptions have been made. And I think, you know, now we can speculate differently. We can ask more questions about it rather than just making this blanket accusation, which the way I see it, based on the circumstances of the whole situation, that those accusations are unfounded.
Deborah G. Plant has been our guest. Again, Deborah G. Plant is an African-American literature and African studies scholar with a special interest in Zora Neale Hurston. She joins us for a conversation on the newly published book from Zora Neale Hurston's first manuscript. It recounts her meetings and interviews with Oluwole Kosola. The book is called Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo. Deborah G. Plant, I thank you greatly for telling us this incredibly important story about both of these people.
You're very welcome. It has been absolutely my pleasure.